Hello, this is Barbara Peters, and it's my pleasure to be talking to Greg Hurwitz, an author whom I have often had conversations with, over the course of many books, and some of them wildly disparately different books. But right now, he is working on a series powered by a guy we call Orphan X. Greg, how did you come to write a series? Because that wasn't really your game.
You know, I had a lot of, I have a really, really bizarre Rolodex. And it's filled with everyone from Navy SEALs to professors to porn stars. And one of the things I realized when I was talking to a lot of guys who were military or intel is they always talked about these programs, black programs, buried very deep in the DOD and how they were funded. And we had a lot of these conversations. And I just thought at one point, how cool would it be if there was a program that took kids out of foster homes and trained them up to be assassins who were totally dispensable weapons? What would it be like if you were that kid? What would the program be like? How would it function? And I just got this into my head, and I was so afraid to write it because I wrote a lot of standalones, as you know, because I've been to the store for, I mean, a dozen of them. And I kept putting it on the back burner and kept putting it on the back burner because I wanted to wait till I had a character that I felt deserved a place on the on the pantheon with Reacher and Bourne. And I kept trying to think about what would make it unique. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if instead of him being trained to be a hard assassin where everything's awful and abusive and it's terrible, what if the guy who pulled him out of that foster home actually was the first person to treat him like a human being and loved him? And that's his father figure and handler, Jack Johns. And when he's 12 years old, Jack says to him, the hard part isn't going to be turning you into a killer. The hard part is keeping you human. And so that's sort of the tragic flaw embedded in Evan, because it would be much easier if he was just an assassin or a true believer. And so when I had that piece of realizing, you know, what if this was the best thing that ever happened to him, even though he's got a lot to reconcile and it's a lot of complications, I thought I had a way into a character with enough traits and differences to really, you know, make a run at it.
I think you did too. I think it helps that you've always had access to medical information. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not a doctor yourself, but all of your books, not all maybe, but most of them have relied, I think, in some part on some medical expertise.
Yeah, well, I'm from a medical family, and my college roommate did me the immense favor of becoming an ER doc. So he's the best, because I call him all the time and say, I need somebody to be severely injured, but not all the way dead. Or I need someone to die in 40 minutes or an hour, an hour and a half. And he's on the case. But I relied a lot on subject matter experts for this. You know, I had to get on every gun that Evan shoots. I did mixed martial arts training, which I don't mean to imply that I did it well. A lot of medical, a lot of computer hacking. There's a lot of stuff because he's... The thing with Evan Smoke is he's not the biggest guy like Reacher, and he's not the most suave womanizer like Bond, and he's not the best shot like Swagger. And for everything he brings, the description I use for him in every book is I say he's just an ordinary guy, not too handsome. And so he has to bring the totality of who he is to every mission to sort of win the day. And he's a lot, to me, he's like Ulysses. He's the man of many wiles, right?
Mm-hmm.
And well, go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say, I think his, I don't want to say ordinariness, but, you know, because he's not Reacher or, you know, standout, I think he is more effective in accomplishing his missions as well. People don't all freeze when he comes into the room mm-hmm. or panic.
No, he just looks, he's an average guy. I mean, right. I based him a lot on me. I'm like, I can fit, you know, in sizes for clothes. You know, I have a tiny wife. I always joke she's like my pocket wife. Her feet are so small, I can't believe that she doesn't just topple over. So everything for her has to be like, you know, custom ordered. I can go into any store, anything fits me off a rack. I'm dead average in almost every way. I thought, wouldn't that be interesting instead of having the most handsome guy or the most buffed guy or the most badass guy? And what really differentiates him, there's always sort of two missions in a mission. Because, so basically, he was in the orphan program, and at a certain point, his moral compass wasn't broken because of what Jack Johns embedded in him, that sense of humanity. So he fled the program, and he became the Nowhere Man, which is a pro bono assassin who people call, the phone number is 1-855 to Nowhere, and you can call it, anyone who'd like to can call it and see what happens, if they're in an impossible situation or in desperate need, and he goes to help them. And it's so interesting because it's almost like every Nowhere Man mission is like him getting a small piece of his soul back. He's trying to kind of burrow his way in towards being a real boy. I think of him in some ways almost like Pinocchio, and he wants to be a real boy.
A real boy, right. Yeah, no, I see that. Well, one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you was that I've had a succession of authors at the store last fall, but especially January, and you all have something in common. So I'm thinking about Nick Petrie. I know you talked to him in Los Angeles, so you can already see where I'm going. Chad Dundas, who is here, has a new guy, first thriller, because he wrote a different book about professional wrestling. I've got Mark Graney coming, Jack Carr, and so forth, but those are different. Those are guys who are Graney and Carr, Stephen Hunter, and all. They're in military fiction. They do, you know, military ops missions for organizations or whatever. But what Nick, and you probably talked to him about it too, and I thought particularly came out in The Wild One, is that he's got his guy who's had military training, and now he's back in civilian life, and he's got, you know, PTSD or whatever fallout from his military goes. But what he really doesn't have is a purpose. He doesn't have a path in life. And he wrestles, I think, in The Wild One tremendously with what, you know, is he just going to accept sort of random missions?
Yeah,
but without a mission, how can he organize his life? How can he run his life? And Joe Finder and I talked about this because Nick Heller is like that. His other books are different, but Nick is another guy with military background and needs a purpose. Chad Dundas's guy is back from the war and has a memory loss rather than PTSD, can't remember anything. So he goes back to his hometown trying to find a mission or a purpose. So I feel like these guys have replaced what used to be the private eye genre, where, you know, you had a private eye and a case was a mission and he often had backup and so forth. But that there are very few private eye books anymore, partly because that's a tough profession in a more modern age. And instead of Hawk, you have a hacker. Instead of Joe Pike, you know, you've got, well, Joe Pike's still with us, so that's not really true. But I'm thinking that these guys that have had military training, you know, and are mission-oriented are really that new genre. And I've got like three of them coming in March because I just finished up looking at March. So it seems to me this is a thing. But you were there early with it.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I thought a lot about was, you know, one of the things that I wanted to do was take a character who feels archetypal. You know, and some of the characters you mentioned are wonderful. I mean, Nick does a great job with Peter Ash with the PTSD. It feels like a very real, tangible thing. It's not a glamorized Hollywood version of PTSD. It's real. He's really exploring what that feels like. And for me, it was a little bit of a different way in that I thought about, like, what if you took a character like Jack Reacher or Jason Bourne, who had all the archetypal badassery, the training, the toughness, all of that, but he lives in the real world where you and I live. And so part of the fun for me in the series is that, you know, Evan will go out, he'll have a mission, he'll get cut, you know, he'll get cut up with a knife and he comes back and like the elderly Jewish woman who lives upstairs from him like demands, you know, of him that to go to the next HOA meeting, right? And then he's stuck doing that because he's this guy who's trying to kind of reconcile his past and he's made a choice to live among people. He lives in this apartment condo in Los Angeles. He's able to kind of disguise and blend in, but whereas he can perfectly calculate the wind drift of a sniper round, he's undone when it comes to making small talk at the mail slots. And so I thought there could be such a fun, constant contrast where he gets on the elevator and he's bleeding out through his sleeve based on a knife wound that he just, you know, that was just inflicted on him. And everybody else is talking about, like, you know, how he's a paper pusher and he doesn't understand real stress and people that don't understand that because he's got this kind of cover identity. And so there's an aspect of it that's really fun for me when I'm thinking about how he's burrowing his way through this sort of archetypal assassin's badass notion of perfection towards actually trying and longing to be intimate or to figure out what that complicated language of intimacy is that I think we all struggle with at different times.
I think he's very different from, say, John Rayne. I always thought that the weakness in Barry Eisler's design for the John Rayne series is that nobody can be totally alone for more than one book. It just, you know, if you want to write a series, there are accretions that happen to it as you move along. And, you know, it just sort of died to me a natural death, and that Rayne acquired two or three. It was the Superman problem. You know, if anyone knew who Rayne, if they targeted him or knew who he was, then anyone around him would be vulnerable. So he was forced to be completely isolated. So Evan goes back and forth with that because he lives in an apartment that's basically, you know, a fortress, right? And yet he has to come out, and then there are other people in the building, and then...
Well, and he has a crush on, like, he has a lot of chemistry with there's a single mom who lives downstairs whose son, Peter, I think reminds Evan of who he was as a foster kid, who's he kind of represents his inner child, and he's got all this chemistry with Mia, but she's a district attorney, so of course if she ever knows what he did for a living, she'd have to arrest him. And so I wanted to have there be a constant churning of different interactions.
Well, that's true, but let's remember too that if somebody figured out who he was when he is being Orphan X, then if he were attached to Mia and her son, they would be in danger.
That's right.
So it's a more complicated problem.
That's right.
You know,
and he puts everyone at risk. Yeah,
right.
It's from both directions.
He's at risk with Mia because of who she is, but Mia's at risk because of who he is.
That's right. And he has to protect from both sides. You know, I learned a lesson. I wrote Batman for 2 years for DC Comics, 2.5 years. And, you know, Robin is always such a confusing character. I mean, some people love Robin. For the most part, everyone likes Batman more than Robin. And, you know, Robin always dies and then he comes back. And, like, Robin has a tough road. But part of why Robin is there is for Batman to have someone to talk to, right? Because when you're dramatizing something, what you want is the interaction and the playfulness, the friction, the conflict. And so one of the things that happened in the third Orphan X book is I introduced a character called Josephine Morales, who's a 16-year-old hacker, who is someone who Jack Johns, who's Evan's handler and father figure, tasks him with in a complicated way that we don't need to get into. And she's got a mouth on her. She's brilliant and difficult, and she's mouthy and denigrating and complicated. And I was planning to kill her at the end of Hellbent. And I got all the way there to the end, and I just realized I couldn't do it. It was so much fun watching him have to interact, having to figure out his awkwardness, and she's quite awkward. And part of what has happened very naturally is that Orphan X, you know, he starts off very much a lone wolf, but there's this community that he starts to enter, right? Tommy Stojak, who's his armorer, who supplies him with the weapons. There's all these people who start to come into it. And one of the things that happened, I didn't plan for this, but it's a source of joy for me, is that, like I said, you know, he's not Reacher, right? He's not Swagger. But all these people who are the experts around him are all better at the one lane than he is. So Joey makes fun of him for his hacking skills, right? And Tommy makes fun of him for his inability to be able to, like, shoot as well as Tommy, right? So we have all these characters who constantly are undermining and cajoling him, which gets me, it's great because I get to use humor to kind of keep constantly taking him down a peg. So they're not ever viewing him with great reverence. So he can do all sorts of things, but usually there's someone who's better at him pointing out that they're better than him at the thing, which is kind of a nice, it's a nice way in to find some intimacy with a character because he's not just like he's the best of the best.
Well, all that's true, but at the same time, you're really assembling a team. So, you know, I could say that there could be an analogy, let's say, to Sigma Force or, you know, even the military fiction guys, that they're a team, you know, because one guy can't do it all.
Mm-hmm.
So, in a way, Evan's building up a team
and
a personal life. And the cliffhanger at the end of this book, you know, certainly suggests to us that there will be a personal life. But... you know, I actually loved Out of the Dark. I think I read the end of it like 5 times. Well, for reasons that I can't give up, but you can imagine were a fantasy that one wishes could come true. But what's also was interesting was the enormous amount of technology, you know, the medical science and all the rest of it that you had put up. And it was a very long game that Evan had been playing in the book. When I thought... that you did that really well. So I think you've tried hard to make each of the books different.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of that came from writing so many standalones in my career.
Right.
You know, so each book, it's not just sort of a new case in a new world, but the books are really built differently. And with Into the Fire, I wanted to build... It's so funny, you know, there's that nursery rhyme of the little old lady who swallowed a fly, and then she swallowed a spider to catch the fly, and then she swallowed a bird to catch the spider. And it's not the most obvious template for a thriller, but I wanted to, I've always wanted to start something where you start to pull a thread and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And so when Evan is first pulled into this mission and into the fire, we think it's finally going to be one that is relatively uncomplicated.
Right.
But it keeps blowing up and keeps blowing up and keeps blowing up until he's essentially in the position of the greatest danger he's ever been, which happens right around chapter 44. I don't want to give away any spoilers, but he essentially, you know, he has to be willing to do anything. If somebody calls him and has nowhere left to turn, he has to do anything he can to help that person.
Right.
And this case pushes him further than any previous case. And after Out of the Dark, you know, where Out of the Dark was essentially my homage to Day of the Jackal, right? It's
yes.
It's Orphan X going up against a highly corrupt president of the United States, and you're rooting for him to win. And, you know, so I was trying to think about how I could reset and push further and do all that. And
right.
So that was this. It starts off this like intimate little case that should just be a breeze. And, you know, by the time we're 2/3 through the book, he's in a position that seems impossible that he's going to get out of.
Yeah, which is scary for the reader and probably loads of fun for you. I was asked not long ago by our staff to come up with an airplane book defined as people rushing in the door on their way to the airport and saying, quick, sell me something, you know, good for the plane. For years, until it really became so out of date we couldn't do it, it was Nelson DeMille's The Charm School. And I'm talking 30 years ago when we first started that. But anyway, it came up again. And so I suggested Orphan X, which is now our official airplane book, the start of a series, really, you know, a great action-driven thriller and so forth, which you could leave alone or continue, depending on what kind of reader you are. But it seemed to me to really... just be the perfect book for that out of a number of things that that I've read. If I were going to have a second candidate, it might be the second Peter Ash, because I think the opening of Burning Bright is one of the most amazing actions.
When I introduced Nick in L.A., it was so funny. I told him the story about leaving your store, and you, like, stapled that book to
I
me.
I did, didn't
yeah,
I?
Yeah, you just took out a nail gun and drilled it to my rear end when I left the store. I told him the first two books I read, I was coerced to read by you. But you were right. It's a great opening. But I remember you told me that specifically. And that's how books and series take shape. It's so much about word of mouth and enthusiasm. It's everything. And I remember you said to me, you pointed that book out, you know, really specifically to me and said, you have to read this book.
Well, I'm so glad that you paid attention, because I do think that I think he's a very talented new writer. And I've always liked the fact that you're so helpful to other writers is a very nice quality.
In general,
thriller writers, I think, are congenial and helpful to
other
writers.
A lot of people were really good to me. You know, I was thinking a lot with the news that Lee Child is taking kind of a half step back now for this next stage of his career. He was so gracious, you know. I mean, he blurbed and helped, and he just did a lot. And so I remember, you know, Crace has been great to me. Connolly, there's so many people who've been wonderful. And, you know, if you're the beneficiary of that, it sets a real... We talk in sports all the time about clubhouse culture with teams. And I think there's a lot of people in the thriller crime fiction community who really set a culture that's really nice. I think we get so much of our shadow out on the page that we don't have time for little petty literary feuds.
That's an interesting point. The other thing is, you know, that it isn't like people who like your book won't read anybody else's book. People who like this kind of book read lots of other books. And so, you know, you don't have to be jealous of your own territory.
The more people doing well, and, you know, the more books being read, the better for everyone.
Absolutely. I think Thriller Fest, the ITW, has done a very good job of fostering that. I've always been pleased that I had that drunken moment at the Arizona Biltmore when I said to the people who then organized it who were unhappy with another organization, well, I'll clean this up. But I said, you know, I'm tired of listening to you. Start your own organization. Mm-hmm. And so they did. And I'm still surprised.
That first meeting at the Biltmore,
yep.
at the Frank Lloyd Wright Biltmore right up the street.
It was. Well, they met here because of that, of that's how it got started. Mm-hmm. And then I think they've been very wise to run it in New York. First place, Phoenix in July is not an ideal mm-hmm. environment, but they have access to a whole lot more stuff in New York. But what I really like is the collegiality of ITW, because I think that it has fostered a lot of new writers. And
that's right. And we had, you know, it was run initially with Gail Lins and David Morrell. You know, they're both class acts.
They are indeed. Well, I'm anxious to see what will happen to Evan in his next book, since, as I say, you've left us with this cliffhanger out of the blue. Did it come to you in a burst, or did you always plan on doing this cliffhanger?
That particular ending. It's so funny. I just thought of this for the first time since, you know, this is my launch day, so it's the first time I'm really talking about this at greater length. When I sold this series, I said, in a future book, that phone's going to ring, and this is who's going to be on the other end of the phone. And I knew that was something that was going to be in there. And I thought, you know, it's like you're selling a first book, right? So I'm like, maybe it's book 5 or 6. And so here we are, and that's, you know, it's going to be book 6.
It's a good thing, because it may take Evan in a different direction. You can't have him just doing the same thing over and over again, even if it's a different mission, you know. So I think you're always thinking, I think, about structure and how to make things different, which is what makes you such a fascinating writer to read.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Greg, for talking to me.